أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد
وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرض روحي وأرواحنا الفداء ولعن الله وعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. لا أقسم باليوم القيامة ولا أقسم بالنفس اللوامة. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. From the enslavement of our desires to the subservience of Allah has been our topic. Tonight is lecture number 4. The attempt so far has been to try to make us understand that there are certain tools that exist in this society that can create idols within us. And as we mentioned yesterday, one of the biggest idol that is created sometimes, that we worship day in and day out, is the idol of ourselves. And we mentioned that the concept of absolute freedom in this world simply doesn't exist. We as individuals, as human beings, we are accustomed to law, to customs, to practices. Those who believe that they are absolutely free are delusional. As I mentioned, the Quran talks about the idea and compares those individuals who have multiple masters to that individual who has one master. It doesn't even entertain the notion that you don't have a master. It compares the source of your enslavement. And the journey that I want to take all of you on, and I'm with you on this journey, is that I want us to go from khud parasti to khuda parasti, inshallah. Where now we go from worshipping and loving ourselves to worshipping and loving Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yesterday we talked about narcissism, the evil, disgusting sin inside of us that forces us, asks us, begs us to worship it. And that is this idea of us loving ourselves, worshipping ourselves, doing everything we can to ensure that we are the end-all and be-all in every conversation, every encounter, every meeting, etc., etc. Today I want to speak a little bit about the concept of the nafs in Islam. I don't know how much we know about the nafs. As a recap to the majority of you, the Quran talks about three different categories of the nafs. In Surah Yusuf, it talks about a nafsi ammara. Inna nafsa l'ammarata bisu, it says. That surely that nafs is that nafs that leads man towards su, towards evil, towards sin. It's that voice inside of us that leads us towards corruption. That voice inside of us that forgets that we begged Allah for forgiveness just last night. That voice inside of us that distracts us from Allah's dhikr, that lets us know that look, you're young, you have your whole life ahead of you. Live your life, tafri, ayashi, enjoy yourself. There's no time right now, you're only 18 years old. There's no reason why you should be performing namaz al-shab at 18 years old. No one has done that when they're 18. They live their life, they party hard, and then by 30, 40, 50, they start to think about their grave. That's that voice inside of you. That's the nafs-e-ammara. And then the Quran talks about the first two ayat of Surah Qiyamah, the ones I read for you in the khutbah. La uqsimu bi yawm al-qiyamata wa la uqsimu bi nafs al-lawwama. Allah swears by the day of judgment and swears by this self-conscious nafs. Lawwama in Arabic comes from lawm, which means regret, which means remorse, which means somebody who's conscious of what they're doing. It's that state of the nafs where we fluctuate between remorse and regret and then breaking Allah's commands. It's that nafs where on the one hand we commit a sin, make a mistake, stumble, trip, and fall, and then almost immediately after we beat ourselves up and saying, why did I commit that sin? We beg Allah for forgiveness, we cry, we swear to Allah, I'll never do this again, I swear Allah. The very next day we do the exact same act. And we go through this nasty fluctuation between the evilness of shaitan and the regret and the remorse of breaking Allah's kingdom. Nafsil lawama. And then of course there is that nafs in Surah Fajr that talks about the Ya ayyutaha nafsul mutma'inna irji'i ila rabbika radiyatan mardiyya. The one that we know, that many mufassirin have said, that the manifestation of this verse, of course, is Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura. That all nafs who is completely mutma'in, has itminan, content, sukoon inside of them, return back to your Lord. Irji'i ila rabbiki. Return back to your Lord in the state that you are pleased and you are pleasing. Where now you please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and in turn Allah is equally pleased with you as well. The ultimate maqam of any nafs is that nafsi mutma'inna, where you and I, inshallah, are striving for. And yeah, there are 6 to 7 different aqsam of the nafs. I don't want to go into that. These three are enough for us to understand where we're at. I would say with such confidence, the majority of us in this audience are in that nafsi lawama category. Now sometimes we trickle into the mutma'in category, and sometimes we trickle into the ammara category, unfortunately. But we put ourselves sometimes through a very daunting, tiring task. We beat ourselves up, we kill ourselves, but we simply can't stop ourselves from sinning. We actually go through sins, my brothers and my sisters, we actually go through sins where we're committing that sin, we're in between that sin, we're actually doing that sin, and we know full well that it's a sin. And we don't even enjoy that sin afterwards. And the moment it's done, seconds after I'm done completing that sin, I'm banging my head against the wall. And I'm begging Allah, Allah, stop me from doing this sin. It's not like I'm ignorant. It's not like I don't know the effects of that sin. I know what sin I'm committing. I even know the effects of that in my grave, in my risk, in my dunya, in my barzakh. I have all that ilm. I still can't stop myself. It attaches itself to you. You become a habitual sinner. It becomes habit to you. It becomes a disposition to you. Part of your malaka, where you can't even stop yourself. The enjoyment of that sin is gone. But you can't stop the attraction of that sin. Because we have repeated that sin so many times that that's all the nafs knows is that sin. It's stripped of any enjoyment. I don't even enjoy it anymore. But I keep doing it. I keep doing it. And while I'm doing it, I'm begging myself to stop. Stop committing that sin. We can't stop. That's not tiring? It's tiring. But that's how much power the nafs has over us. It can literally take your aql and your reasoning and your logic and dump it to the side and force you at your will to commit that sin, even though from beginning to end you don't enjoy a lamha of that sin. If you allow the sin to be habitual in that nature. And sometimes we do. We are unfortunately habitual sinners. We sin a few sins, but we do them so constantly that they become part of our soul. It becomes an addiction. You're screaming for help. You're asking for help. You're begging for help. Allah, make me stop wanting to commit this sin. Wallah, I don't want to commit this sin anymore. And within hours, we're right exactly where we left off. This sin is, this nafs is not a joke. It's a powerful entity. It's consumed men in history. It's consumed the young. And I want to make sure tonight we understand the power of that nafs. Because we are up against a massive beast inside of us. There's a reason why the Holy Prophet said, compared to you giving your life in the Maidan of the Jung, compared to you being surrounded by spears and arrows, compared to you facing an army of sometimes 300, 400, 500 people who simply want to kill you, that's the minor jihad. That's nothing compared to the Holy Prophet. The major one is you fighting your nafs. That's harder, the Holy Prophet says. That's more difficult than you sitting there and trying to flee from a shower of arrows coming at your head. Why? Because you're fighting yourself. It's very easy. The enemy is mushakhas. What his plans are is very known. What his ploy are is very known. What I have to do to destroy this enemy is very well known. No problem. I'll execute. But when you are up against an enemy within yourself, that is yourself, that you feed constantly, that you've been feeding since you were a child, that now is the source of your pleasure in this world, that gives you everything you've ever wanted. If you say, I want A, B, and C, he says, yes, sir, I'll give you A, B, and C. Just don't leave my side. Continue to feed me. As long as you feed me, I'll give you my pleasure. No worries. And now Islam says, fight that source? Wait a second, no? That's a source of my pleasure. I get immense pleasure from this nafs that Islam is telling me to fight. And yes, that is exactly what Islam is saying, is to fight that nafs. Very difficult. I'd rather shoot a few arrows and take a few arrows in my leg than fight this friend of mine who's been with me since day number one. When everybody was gone, my nafs was there to please me. At 1 o'clock in the morning, the entire world is asleep. My nafs is there to please me. You want me to defriend this individual? Forget it. Jihad Akbar. And those who have gained anything in this world, forget the a'immah, they're different. Ulama, pious individuals. If they gained any maqam in the eyes of Allah, it's because they conquered their nafs. Nothing else. We're up against a massive beast. At this age right now that all of you are at, that I was at several years ago, it consumes you. It's all you guys think about. So we have to understand the power of the beast we're up against. Because we're trying to avoid us from being enslaved by this nafs. You know, it's one thing where you have a master, you have a slave. And provided that the slave does everything the master says, the master is content. The master asks the slave to do, look, this is your list of duties, 1 to 10. Do them, I'm happy, no problem. That's simple enough. But with the nafs, when the nafs is your master, the nafs is never satisfied. Ever satisfied. The more you feed it, the hungrier it gets. The more you fill it, the bigger it gets. You think for a moment the jug has 2 liters of capacity. You have water for 10 liters. But the more you pour it, the more bigger and bigger and bigger it gets, to the point where it becomes completely out of control and you are a slave of your desires. And we've seen that enslavement destroy families, destroy communities, destroy faith, destroy individuals. Man dakhalahu ujba halak, I said yesterday. The one who allows narcissism to enter the heart has and will be destroyed. Halak. Fir'aun is gone. Namrud is gone. Qarun is gone. One by one, they're all gone. There are people who went around and said, Ana Rabbil Alameen, I am the Lord of the worlds. Worship me, worship me. Where are you now? It destroyed you. Your grave could be filled with gold. You could wrap yourself all you want like a mummy to preserve your body. At the end of the day, you're dead. And your dhikr is nowhere in this world. And you sold your soul out for this world. That's why Amir al-Mu'mineen says, if you're going to sell your soul in this world, sell it for a price higher than Jannat. That's what you're giving up. You want this world? It's yours. This world is yours. Every ounce, every disgusting corner of this world is yours. Make sure that is equal, if not more, than paradise itself. If there's no comparison, Asabai, come on, this world and paradise, there's no comparison. Jannat is Jannat, man. That's why we're here, right? To gain heaven. To think about your decisions. What are you giving up? And for what? A lamha of shahwa, a moment of desire, a night of desire. This nafs is very, very powerful. So powerful, our holy prophet, Muhammad al-Mustafa, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alayhi Muhammad.
Look at his very powerful hadith. You guys are all with me, inshallah? Yes, not an easy discussion. He says, Ya ilahi, la takilni ila nafsi tarfata aynin abada. Allah. Oh Allah, do not leave me at the disposal of my nafs for a blink of an eye. Who's saying this, guys? The Holy Prophet saying this? The Habib of Allah is saying this? Ashraf al-Makhluqat, the best of the creations, is saying this? The one who is the recipient of Allah's wahi is saying this? The one who is rahmatil lil alameen is saying this? Yes, he's saying this. Do not leave me, Allah. Do not leave me with my nafs alone in the room. I'm paraphrasing. For a blink of an eye, a fraction of a second. Tarfata aynin abada. Please, don't. It's too powerful. Now, does that mean what? The Prophet couldn't handle? No, of course not. Let's be a little bit, have a little bit more sha'ud about that. He's trying to describe to you the power of the nafs. If you allow it, it will devour you and spit you out like you are nothing. And sometimes we fool ourselves, don't we? Sometimes we think, you know what? I'm good. I'm pious. I've actually heard youth sometimes overhear them say, you know, the amount that I've achieved in this world, I think is good enough to get heaven. I'm good. If I just continue on this path, I should be okay. I don't see God punishing me for all the mistakes I've made. Be careful of those thoughts. Those are satanic thoughts. That's shaitan blocking your progress. Jalaluddin Rumi has very famous port, as many of you know. Maulavi, or Maulana as he's called in Iran, has a collection of poems. And that book is called his Mathnavi. And what Rumi used to do is he used to describe Islamic principles and concepts through his poetry in the form of stories. He's highly respected amongst the Islamic world, Shia and Sunni both, even amongst the scholars. There's a very famous story of a snake catcher, and I want you guys to understand this for a moment. We're talking about the power of the nafs. Know who you're up against in your battle. Remember, this is not news to anybody, by this is all reminders for myself and for all of you. You all of us have an outward guide and an inward guide, an outward enemy and an inward enemy. Very, very clear. Outward enemy is shaytan. Lakum ma'adubum mubin. He's your open enemy, the Quran says. Nothing he ever whispers to you is good for you. Everything he's asking you to do is for your destruction. He has no purpose and no mission to befriend you, only to destroy you. The inner enemy is your nafs, this beast that we're up against, the snake catcher. One salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
There's a man in a town, Rumi writes, who was a snake catcher. He'd go around catching snakes. He wasn't very good at it, so he didn't have a lot of respect amongst the people. One day he found himself in the mountains in the dead of winter, And on his journey, lying in front of him was a massive python, frozen, buried under snow. His eyes lit up. He thought to himself, man, if I get this snake back into town, I will earn the respect of everyone and anybody. I'll shut up my critics. Drags his python into town. Everyone's amazed. Announces to the town that, look at me. All hail me. I am the man. I caught this python. Everyone gathers and says, wow, look at this snake catcher. He's amazing. We underestimated him. And this man felt good about himself. He's popping his collar, as you guys would say. Felt good. All of a sudden, the clouds began to part. And this bright, hot, burning sun comes about and directly hits that snake. The snake is frozen. It's not dead. The sun hits the snake begins to melt and comes to life. And the first person it devours is the snake catcher. Rumi goes on to say that this story describes one concept to us. We, of course, are the snake catcher. The snake is our nafs. Sometimes we think that nafs is dormant, it's dead. Right? I used to do things when I was 18, 19, 20. I don't do them anymore. Alhamdulillah, I've conquered my nafs. Look at the ghurur. Right? I was bad at this. I had a habit of doing this. Alhamdulillah, now I don't have that anymore. My nafs has to be dead. Or my nafs is in my control, let's say, for example. And then he says, what? That sun is the sun of the desire of your soul. That comes and shines down on that nafs and literally gives it life. And now this nafs that you thought was dormant, your guard was down. For a moment you turned your back, you thought, good, he's dead, he's gone, forget about him. You turn around, that nafs devours you. And now you're back 2 steps. When in actuality you thought you were ahead 10 steps. And that's when we fall into hopelessness, guys. That's when we fall into na'umisi and ma'yusi and na'umidi. That's when we think, you know, asabai, I can't do it. I've tried, I can't do it. I can't fight shaitan. He gets me every single time. The moment that I take 1 step forward, I take 5 steps back. I'm tired, I can't do it anymore. I surrender to shaitan. The first step in understanding your battle is to know who your enemy is. To know exactly what's happening. And while there are several steps in you fighting your nafs, 1 step I want to talk about from the world of Irfan, inshallah, will give us some light. 1 salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa
my older youth in the audience, even if you are fathers in the audience and mothers, please follow me for a second. If you can get this, I'm happy. When you study Irfan, which all of us like to study, right? Irfan is, ooh, it's mysticism, it's Gnostic, oh, it's nice. I want to fly through walls. I want to be in Mashhad at 8 o'clock in the evening, right? I want to walk on water, you know? I want to look at you and tell you what your barzakh is, right? All these things, you know? Tell me about Ayatollah Bahjat al-Sabai. Who is Ayatollah Bahjat al-Sabai? Yeah, yeah. You guys love Irfan, right? So I figured let's use an Irfanic example, right? Because to you, he's probably some member of the Marvel or DC Comics or some superhero that has a, you know, a moon and a star and he's going out fighting his nafs. And Shaykh Mutahari rahmatullah alayhi introduces Irfan in several stages. Irfan in nadari, not amali. Theoretical Irfan. Follow me for a second, please. I don't want to lose anybody here. He says the very first stage of Irfan is what's called irada, will, or in Iran, irade. Anyways, that's an inside Iranian joke. Wrong crowd. Shaykh Mutahari describes this stage very beautifully. He says, I want you to imagine that your entire circle of life, from when you were born to when you die, it are 2 crescent halves. You stick them together, you have 1 big circle, okay? or two half moons. Or for those of you, I know it's, you know, you guys just ate, right? So two Joe Louis, let's say, for example, to put together is one big circle. Okay? He says your start point is an X on top of the circle. That's when you were born. And then he says you go through two stages. One is the stage of Nuzul, and one is the stage of Sa'ud. I'll explain those in a moment. He says you live your life, you live your life, you live your life. And he says the entire encompassing circle revolves around one ayat. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Now we believe that that verse is strictly made for those who are dead, gone in this world. Shaykh Muhtari says, no, this ayat is very much about life in this world. In fact, several times a day, we become a manifestation of this verse. We are from Allah, and to Him we will return. When you start off, you wake up in the morning, you tell yourself, you know what, tonight is Shab-e Qadr. I'm going to go, put on white, do my ghusl, put my itr on. I'm ready. Mufati in one hand, tasbih, Quran, dhikr, ya Allah, it's on my head. Let's do this. No more. Tomorrow, I'm a brand new person. Inna lillahi, we are from Allah. And then we lose our way 2 or 3 days down the road. We become ghafil, we become heedless, we become distracted by this world. We forget about that moment when we're looking up at the screen and we're seeing and hearing the masail of Imam Hussein. There's the Quran on our head, there's tears in our eyes, dhikr of Imam Hussein on our lips. We're begging Allah, please, I don't want to be this person anymore. Wallah, I want to be a better person. Help me tonight, help me tonight. 3 days later, we forget all that. It's gone. That spark lasted one night. And then we lose off the track. We are from Allah, but then we drift over there somewhere. And then all of a sudden we have that moment where we come back. وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. And we return back to Allah. And this happens several times a day sometimes. It's not just about being born and dying and you just say, oh, inna lillah. No, sometimes this phenomenon of leaving Allah, returning back to Allah, leaving Allah, returning back to Allah, happens, like I said, and keep saying, several times a day. And when you are born, you start off by saying, inna lillahi. And then you live your life. You're 10, you're 11, you're 12. And right now, Islam is completely biological. You pray namaz because your dad said to pray namaz. You wear hijab because your mom wears hijab. You come to the center because you're dragged to the center. Everything is biological, biological, biological. All of a sudden now, you have a spark, Shaykh Mutahari says. Every human being goes through a spark. And that spark is a discussion you have with yourself about three things. Your origin, your purpose, your destination. It is the fitrat of the insan to eventually ask themselves those three questions. Where did I come from? What am I doing in this world? And where am I going? And that spark, he says, breaks the biological barrier of being a Muslim and now begins that haqiqi transformation into being an actual Muslim. Because now when you think about an origin, you think about Tawheed. Discussion on God, you go, you research Big Bang Theory, you research Darwinism, you research Tawheed, you do all these things. You have all these questions, you don't ask an alim because you're ashamed. What if the guy thinks I don't believe in God? So you keep these questions to yourself. You have these doubts about God, and that doubt affects your salat, affects your psalm, affects every form of your worship because you haven't fixed the bunyad yet. But you think, you contemplate, you question, you wonder, is there a God? Can there be a God? Why can't there be more than one God? And then you talk about your purpose and the idea of Nubuwwat and Imamat comes about. They were brought down to purify us. وَيُزَكِّيهِمْ وَيُعَلِّمُهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحِكْمَةِ. The Quran says, the Prophet was brought down to purify you, to teach you wisdom and the book. And then you turn and you talk about destination, you talk about the Day of Judgment. And sometimes that spark is enough for you to wake up and say, you know what? I've been doing all of this for the wrong reasons. And now you wake up and all of a sudden the next morning, you leave your house with the hijab on your head. Allahu Akbar. Uh-oh, things are different now. I have this scarf on my head. Or you begin to not shave and begin to kind of, you know, form your beard. And your boys see you and say, yo, that's a sick beard, yo. And like, wait, that sounds pretty good. And then you actually crack open the Quran and start to read the Quran. And begin to ponder on verses. Text Asabhai about tafsir of certain verses. Start to ask questions. And then that spark happens. And then that iman builds. And now all of a sudden this tastes pretty good. And now this purpose, this hayat, and this maqsad becomes a little bit more clear. A little bit more clear to me. And then Shaheed Mutahhari says that spark takes you from Nuzul to Sa'ud. Nuzul is your descension. You are from Allah and you brought down to this earth and you're living. That spark now tells you that I'm not only from Allah, I have to what? Return back to Allah now. So now my journey begins back to Allah. Wa inna ilayhi raja'un. And that spark now transforms me, opens my eyes, makes me realize my mistakes, understand what's happening around me. Fudail ibn Ayaz is a story I've told several times to all of you. In a book called Misbah al-Sharia, The Lantern of the Path, which is attributed to Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wa salam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
The individual who is responsible for compiling this book, some ulama say, is a person named Fudail. It's a very famous story. I'm sure majority of you have heard it. If you don't mind, with your permission, I'd like to repeat that story. Fudail was a master thief. If you wanted anything stolen from anyone's house, you would ask Fudail. He'll get it for you. His khas method was that he would climb the roof and through the roof would enter the house, take what he wanted and go back through the roof again. The story goes on to say that one day he cut a little square inside the roof. He was about to enter the house of this mu'min to steal his property. And that mu'min at 2 o'clock in the morning was reading the Quran out loud. And he's reading an ayat from Surah Hadid, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's ayat number 16. That talks about the idea that is it not about time that Allah's servants realize that what they're doing is wrong? Half of a verse stopped Fudail in his tracks. The way that the books at least describe, he sat on the roof and he stopped for a moment. And he thought to himself, what am I doing? What kind of life am I living? Climbed down off the roof and went to the door of Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. And knocked on the door and said, Mawla, I want you to please take me under your wing. He became one of the biggest arifs of the time of our sixth Imam. A spark of a half a verse. I ask myself before I ask any of you who are listening to my voice, when is our spark going to come? What is our spark? Is it a tragedy in our life? We lost our father, we lost our mother, we lost our spouse, we lost our child. Is it one day you wake up and say, I'm done this life. I want to turn back to Allah now. Wa inna ilayhi raji'un. I want to transform my life from Nuzul to Sa'ud. I want that done now. That spark that Shaheed Mutahhari is describing, that spark is called Irada. First step in Irfan is to have that Irada. And when I say spark, I don't mean a spark of ghaflat, where you have the spark, yeah man, I'm ready, let's do this. You wake up tomorrow morning, you're the exact same person. That's not a spark. It was something, wasn't a spark. A spark creates electricity, right? To build a fire, sometimes all you need is a spark from two rocks or friction from two sticks. or a spark to catch something on fire. That's the idea. Take that spark now and enlighten the dark corners of your nafs and begin that process now of irada. It's no longer that you're living a life of nuzul. You now have a journey back to Allah. If that happens at 16, great. 26, great. 36, great. Whatever. Whenever it happens, accept the spark and let's move on. Identify your spark. What will take you out of this rut? What will take you out of the bare minimum and make you go one notch higher? And that spark could be anything. It was half a verse of Allah's, of the 6,600 plus verses, half of one of them was enough for them. And the result of that was what? An arif in the time of Imam Sadiq. Are you kidding me? Identify your spark. And once you found that spark, once you tell yourself, if you leave here tonight and say, you know what, I'm ready for a change, don't let that slip from your hands. The moment that that enters your head, have a plan, have a strategy, write it down, take a picture, order it online, whatever the case may be, remind yourself of that spark. I remember, I told the story before, maybe not here, maybe somewhere else. I went to a community one time in the US, I went to that community and there was one sister who I met who just started wearing hijab 6 months before I arrived. And she was very proud of it. She should be, mashallah. My respect and salam to those sisters who wear hijab in this society. As guys, I don't think we realize how difficult it is. It's not easy. And God sees that. Wallahi, God sees that. And she came to me and she told me straight out that Sayyid, if you met me 10 months ago, you wouldn't recognize me. I didn't have this thing on my head 10 months ago. I mean, she had it proper. Like, she was all, you know, ding, ding, ding. All the pins were all in the right spots. It's not like it was flowing and slipping off. No, she was, you know, she had the thing and everything. It was proper, man. She did her research. You know, it was matching her purse. Everything was, you know. And but she came to me with pride. And I, you know, I encouraged her. I said, mashallah, it's fantastic. I'm very happy. I asked her, what was that moment that made you wear hijab? And she said, it's a book that I read. I read the book from front to cover because a friend of mine said, just read this book and let me know what you think. The contents of that book hit me so hard, it changed my life completely. I said, okay, and I left it. The next year I came back to that same community and that same sister now was nowhere to be seen. And the reason why she was nowhere to be seen was because I couldn't recognize her. Her hijab came off, unfortunately. And when I inquired about other individuals, one sister came to me and said that, what do we do as her friends? She stopped wearing hijab. And I asked him, and this is all advice I get from the Hausa. Nothing comes from this brain, because there's nothing in this brain to give to anybody. Everything is from the Hausa. The ulama say that if people lose that spark, reintroduce that spark to them. They had a bookstore in the center. I told this friend of hers, go, this is the book that sparked her, buy that book and give it to her. Tell her to read it again. I don't know what happened, I didn't follow up, but that's what we need to do. The spark, as quickly as it comes, it can die that much quicker if we allow it. Because now the nafs will take notice, the nafs antenna will go up. And say, oh, this person actually wants to fix themselves. They want to fight me, take me on, destroy me, minimize me, little me, belittle me, everything. Okay, let's get it on. And sleeves go up and now they throw everything at you. That's why I've always told all of you, I tell myself every day, find out what is it that extinguishes that spark inside of you. What turns you ghafil from Allah? What turns you heedless from Allah? And fight that. If you tell yourself on the night of Shab al-Qadr that that's it, from tomorrow I am not going to listen to music. It's my addiction. I can't cook without it. I can't drive without it. I can't study for my exams. I'm sorry. I can't cram for my exams without it. I can't do any of it without music. I have to have something in my ear. It's my addiction. First thing I would say to you is thank Allah that you've recognized what your addiction is. And secondly, now work towards it. And then for a week, 10 days, let's say, for example, you're going good. No songs, no music. You know, you're twitching, you're shaking. That's fine. That's all part of the process. But you're moving forward. And then a friend of yours all of a sudden on Facebook puts up as her status the latest song of some Bollywood hits or something. You gotta check this out. I know of anybody who would love it, you would love it. And you don't want to click on it, but you're looking at it and you're like, and you click. And that's it. The spark is dead and you're back to 10 days ago. And you stop and you identify, I was good for 10 days. What pulled me off the path? Fine, it was me. But this person, with all due respect, lured me onto the path that I'm trying to avoid. Recognize that. Sometimes the people around us pull us to do things that we don't want to do. I've told my youngsters, my young ones in the audience, be careful who your friends are. Your circle of influence is very, very important. And I give you my example. I went through circles upon circles in high school. And now I have a tight-knit circle that I'm very proud of. I would die for my brothers. I'm blessed to have that circle. Because when I sit with them, they remind me of Allah. And if you have that, Amirul Mu'mineen says, it's a blessing of a lifetime if you have one person like that. We have 10 others that will pull us off the path. We need one to pull us back on the path. And say, look, you were doing so good for 10 days. What happened to you? It's person X. They put up something on Facebook. I couldn't control myself. And now you're back. And the problem is this. This is the biggest problem. That when you have progression of 10 days and you end up back, not only do you come back, but you come back with a thought that thinking, look, I tried for 10 days. I couldn't do it. I'm not going to try again. And now you come back worse off than you were before. And it's daunting to get back to that. But that's what we have to do. Gotta get back. That's why when you pick up books like Jamil Sadat, for example, basic akhlaq book by Aghay Naraki, it's available online in English. It's not a very good translation. The Farsi and Arabi are better, but it's a good start to a discussion on akhlaq. Jamil Sadat. In there, the author talks about and compares the nafs to a corporation. Like I love to do in my darses sometimes. But he says that just like a corporation, let's say, has 7 departments, okay? Marketing, accounting, IT, sales, I don't know, leadership, operations, logistics, all these different departments exist to make up the company, okay? As long as the departments are functioning as they should, the company is successful. The moment that IT drops and sales drops and marketing drops, the company will crumble, correct? So what leadership has to do, what the CEO or the board has to do, is constantly meet up with these departments every 3 months, every quarter, and review their progress and say, look, you were created for this purpose. Have you met that purpose in the past 3 months? If you haven't, let's get you some help. If you have, very good, keep doing your work, let's move on. And you do that, they do that for every single one of the 7 departments. Aghay Naraki says that we equally have 7 departments. Our eyes, our ears, our tongue, our stomach, our private parts, our arms, our legs. 7 departments of a corporation. And we are the CEO of that corporation. And just like any other corporation does a performance review of what they should be doing and shouldn't be doing, we equally have to do a performance review of our departments. Sit there and talk to your eyes, man. Say, dude, are you looking where you should be looking? Talk to your ears. And if your eyes, mashallah, and like I always say, pat yourself on your back. Give yourself small victories. If you're able to lower your gaze when non-metam are in front of you, fantastic. Say, department of the eyes, you guys are the best. Move on. I have no qualms with you. But when it comes to the ears, every little hint of music, you're there in the mix, in the middle. Put the volume up. You call up the wedding party and say, you know, who's your DJ? Okay, I'll be there. Department of the ears, not so good. You sit down and you reprimand them. You sit down, you get them help. You sit down and you remind them what your purpose is. There are people who live to eat. There are people who eat to live. Right? So all these things are there for us to understand how to handle our nafs. Amir al-Mu'mineen says the nafs is like a wild horse. You have to jump on that horse and you have to direct it where it goes. If you leave that horse, it will take you wherever it wants to go, not the other way around. Isn't that you and I sometimes? Are we on this horse and wherever this horse goes, we're going this way, we're going that way. We have no control. And eventually it'll kick us off and we're left stranded. We need to identify, my brothers and my sisters, the strength of our nafs. And part of it is mindset. Part of the problem is mindset. We don't have the right mindset going into this battle with our nafs. We believe that we're already defeated. We walk in, we think, you know what, I can't do it. When Amir al-Mu'mineen used to prepare his soldiers for army, he'd always tell them to not look at the front row of the fighters. Look at the enemy's last rank. Because if you look at the enemy's last rank, you've defeated the entire army from the first rank to the last rank. You know that the way the Arabs used to fight, they would send their three or four best forward, and you would send your three or four best forward, and you would fight. You'd move on to the second row. The best of the best of the best fighters were the first line, the strongest ones. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, look at them as if they're nothing. Look past them. They don't even exist in your eyes. You've conquered them already. Move over. Move on to the last row. Sometimes we need to do that as well. And understand that we are far better than this nafs thing. I mentioned the very, very first night, the reason why I started off with Qadr Shinasi, understanding our daraja in the eyes of Allah. Of every existence in this world, He chose us to be His Khalifa, guys. Us. To represent Him in this world. There's no bigger blessing than that. He's telling the angels that you don't know about this insan what I know about this insan. He's not created just to praise me and just to circulate me. He's for something else. Understand your battle, understand who you're up against. The very first step in ensuring you don't become an abd of your nafs is to understand who's trying to master you. And I don't ever want to hear anyone in this room tell me that I'm too young for this, I'm too weak for this. I've said this before in Marhuma Fizza's majlis. Islam was created and introduced on the back of the youth of Islam. People like Bilal Habashi, like Amir al-Mu'mineen, like Jafar al-Tayyar, like there's many, many others. Islam was defended and once again conquered by youth on the day of Ashura. Janab Qasim, Ona Muhammad Ali Akbar, a 6-month-old Ali Asghar. And Imam Zaman's mission will be again successful because of the youth. There is no better time to begin this process than now. We have hadith that says that the one who learns something new in their youth, it's like they carve it in a rock forever to remain. And the one who learns something new when they're in their old age, it's like they write it in the sand, easily washable. Begin to carve things in your rock, guys, besides I was here. Begin to carve from now. That stuff doesn't go away. There'll be attempt upon attempt to wipe that out. You can't wipe it out. Because this deen, this religion, has been brought to us and given to us through immense sacrifice. And nobody went through as much sacrifice as our first Mawla. I mentioned last night that he was awwal al-madhloom. He was a man who wasn't the first to be madhloom. He was a man who was victim of the most oppression. Muawiyah, the people like Muawiyah, weren't just about defeating Ali alayhi salam. They were about assassinating his character. They wanted his name to have nisbat with la'an and cursing and other disgusting, disgusting words. This was a man who fed the orphans. This was the man that when he left on Shab-e-Zarbat, on the morning of the night of Ramadan, small little animals would tug on his abba and say, Ya Mullah, where are you going? These were individuals who had hope because Ali was still there. How can a man like that have such enmity, such enemies? A companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen began to follow Amir al-Mu'mineen from the masjid to the house. And as I said yesterday, Amir al-Mu'mineen told his sons that ensure that none of my ashab come with me to the house. My daughters are in the house. I don't think we can understand that for a moment. I really don't. This man was just struck with a vicious sword. He was struck so hard, it went through his brain into his forehead. He couldn't walk. Never in the history has anyone seen Amir al-Mu'mineen who needed help to get up from the ground. But on one side was Hassan, on one side was Hussein, carrying their father home. And in that state, when he is in so much pain, when there's poison that's penetrating inside his brain, his only thoughts were his two daughters, Zainab and Umm al-Kulthum. But that companion didn't listen. And said, I have to see my mullah one last time, please, I beg of you. Imam Hassan inside the room says, Baba, there's a companion who really wants to see you. The companion describes that when Amir al-Mu'mineen opened the door, he had a cloth around his forehead that was stained with the poison. And he said that the poison was so vicious that literally in front of my eyes, I could see that the skin of my mullah and the color of the cloth were one. He said, Mullah, I'm sorry, I know you need to rest. I just wanted to send my last salams to you. And he's crying in front of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he says that I'm on my way to paradise. There's no reason for you to be upset. He says, you're right. I have no doubt about the fact that you'll be in paradise. But Mullah, I'm simply going to miss you when you leave. I don't know who I'm going to turn to. I don't know who I'm going to talk to. I don't know who's going to be my mushkil kusha at this moment. He comes inside the house. And everybody is around him, his children. And although I haven't seen a riwayat or anything in the books, the ulama do say that there had to have been a conversation with him and his children. You don't become in that state, you don't become on the verge of death without having a conversation with your children. And the one conversation that many of the ulama describe is that between a father and a daughter. I mentioned to some of my brothers the other night that Zainab is two words, Zain and Ab. Zain comes from Zinat, beauty, and Ab, of course, his father. She was the beauty of her father. This was the same Zainab that the neighbors of Amir al-Mu'mineen would say that we never saw the daughters of Amir al-Mu'mineen, ever saw them. That when they wanted to go see and visit the grave of their father, they would shelter their sister, Imam Hasnain would. and one side was Amir al-Mu'mineen, on the left and right were Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. I could see there was somebody going towards the grave, but wallah, I couldn't make out who it was. That's how careful they were about Bibi Zainab. When Amir al-Mu'mineen would go for a journey and return back to Kufa, he would literally sometimes wait until the sun set, complete darkness, to re-enter the city just for the fear that someone's eyes might lay on Zainab. It's a good thing, Mawla, you weren't in Bazar al-Sham. It's a good thing you weren't in that Darbar of Yazid, where that same Zainab stood there in front of so many men. It's a good thing, Mawla, that you weren't there after